to my son at home, Carlos Tini. Today is Tuesday, April 5th, 2016. I'm Senator Mayor Pasquale, and I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Peaceful and also Senator Ellis. The time is 1:35. I'd like to thank the recording secretary, Carrie, and then I'll wrap up with this meeting. Thank you for being here. Oh, I'm sorry. For being here today. We have a full agenda today. We have the final of our 60 board appointments that we'll be hearing for today. Joey Merrick, who's on the Arts and Development Development Corporation. And Sandy will be forwarding all of the names together following Mr. Merrick. And then following that, we'll have House Bill 155, Senate Bill 201, Senate Bill 175, Senate Bill 156, Senate Bill 193, and House Bill 268. So with that, let's get started. Mr. Merrick, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Welcome, and thank you for making yourself available today to the committee. One of the things that we mentioned to all of the nominees from boards and reappointments is that we certainly appreciate your willingness to serve in this capacity to the state of Alaska and the board that the corporation that you're a member of is certainly one of the most high profile in the state. And the work that you are doing is certainly very important to our future. So with that, I want to just say that we'll just give you a few minutes to introduce yourself to the committee and express your interest in continuing to serve on the USPS and Development Corporation Board of Directors.
Okay, thank you, first of all, I'm sorry to Joey Merrick, I'm sorry I'm not able to be here in person, but I had a cold knee replacement just a couple of weeks ago, I'm still actually not working. But yeah, my background, first in Alaska, the board, engineering board, and I went to school up in Little Catholic in Fairbanks. In 1989, I started working construction. I've been in the construction industry since then, so over 25 years. I started as an apprentice to the laborers union. And then I worked on many pipelines, gathering stations, and built pipelines all the way from the stream and the pipe tunnels, pipeline, every stage of the run all the way to the higher test, so I've been involved in that. Also worked on the pipeline for a number of years, including up and down the line, including probably East Coast up in Eternal, overseeing many projects there as a superintendent and manager. And, let's see, I've recently, the last 15 years, I've been working with the laborers union. As a business agent, now as a business manager, I represent 5,000 members of the President of the District Council of Laborers, all of us being Alaskans. And I'm also involved in workforce development quite a bit. I've been on the workforce development board in the state for a number of years, and I continue to work on the trustee and the laborers pipeline training trust. Also a trust minimum pipeline training school in Fairbanks. Let's see, I'm a president of the Alaska Petroleum Joint Craft Council, which is pipeline trade for the state of Alaska. I work a lot on representing the members as well as negotiating contracts with ABC industry folks. Construction sector as well as tourism. We've obtained the province of Alaska Regional Pandemic, and I understand how to put deal together, how to negotiate contracts, how to balance what's best for everybody, making sure that it's kind of a fair deal from all parties' perspective. I think this is a critical project. I know it's a critical project for state, especially right now, where our budget where it is. And I'm honored to serve on the EDC, and I hope we continue to serve better to get the project for
Chair, I appreciate your work on the board. How do you manage? I know it's a very demanding board, and you have a full-time job. How does that work out?
Well, you're absolutely right, Mr. Chair. Every diesel, I think on big responsibility. I think it's probably the most important work that can be done. Not just for the numbers that I represent, but for all of Washington. So it has been a challenge, I can tell you. There's no question about it, especially from a total knee replacement and all of it. But I think it's something that I'm willing to do. I mean, work and stuff. attend all the meetings and all the reception surgery and have to be very involved and focused on the work that we're doing. But you're absolutely right. It's pretty challenging.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any
further
questions
of
committee
members? Okay, seeing that, is there anyone in the public here in the chamber that would like to testify related to Jerry Merrick's nomination for the AGDC board? Is there anybody online who wishes to testify? Post public testimony. And with that, I want to thank you again, Mr. Mayor, for making yourself available today and also for serving on this really important board. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Members of the committee, that concludes our consideration of the 60 nominees to state boards and commissions that we've reviewed in this committee. I want to thank all of you folks for your time and your willingness to serve on us, and we will be moving forward with the committee report. In accordance with AS39.05.OAM, Labor and Commerce Committee reviewed the attached nominees and recommends the appointments and forwarded to a committee session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent by any member of the committee to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any future sessions, so we'll take a brief and meaningful study of the paperwork. Welcome back to the Labor Commerce. Next, we have on our agenda House Bill 155 by Representative Thompson. It's about fees, taxes, and credits bill. This is the bill's second hearing, and we close public testimony to hear Susan and Dr. Commute substitute take any members' questions and then look to the committee. So with that, Senator Diesel, will you move this yes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee substitute. The committee adopted the committee substitute of HB 155 working document number LS0715-PAPA as the working document.
I will object to the committee discussion. And we have Melissa Garland, the committee, explaining the committee substitute.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Miller, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And the committee substitute, Madam Chair, makes three changes. The first occurring, and it removes Section 5 of the original bill. I'll give members as a momentary reference that if you would like. The Section 5, Madam Chair, dealt with motor fuel taxes. This section was removed at request of the sponsor. That issue was being handled by other pieces of legislation before the legislature, and there was a room for the request of the sponsor. The conforming changes, some of that, Chair, fall down the renumbering of 5, 6, 7 in the CBS. Madam Chair, the second and third changes to the bill change the effective date. This was a conforming updated change on page 5 of the bill, lines 22 and 23, changing section 11 to have an effective date of January 1st, 2017, section 12 to have an effective date of July 1st, 2016. This is to account to taxes that are collected or calculated on a monthly and annual scale. Those include the changes in the CS manager.
I'll remove my objection to having the CS. Is there any further objection to the CS? Now, I'm going to invite Representative Wilson and Lori Anderson more and ask the committee if you have any questions for the bill sponsor, and also give you a chance to provide remarks if you like.
Thank you. I'm not Eddie C. Thompson from House District 2, working for banks, and we are reviewing the bill. The changes are being addressed. The first one in Section 5, that is being addressed in another bill, so we have no problem with that. And it's confirming needs at the end of the year. Now, I'm bringing it to this year for the draft of last year, so then on base here. So we don't have any problem with the changes. I think it's a move in the right direction. But no came about because of the direct expenditure requirements put in a couple of years ago, and this was not a report we had. This was a start of trying to reduce those indirect expenditures, tax credits, and fees that we felt were existing or weren't serving the purpose.
Do any members have questions for the sponsor? Thank you very much. We also have the administration ask the board members if there are any questions for the Department of Revenue. Any questions for the members? Okay. All the members are present. You don't want to come to the table, but Senator Byron has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Thompson. this is a great bill. It deals with credits and deductions and taxes. But it's not comprehensive. It's going to be 20 different tax credit bills that we have out there. It seems like the past month has had 3 or 4 years ago dealing with fish tax credits, non-treated salmon or something. And I know there's some education tax credits out there. So you've picked a few here, but are there more that we should be considering, or is this the...
There are a lot of them in the original report, but they're very thick. These we felt like were these low-hanging fruit to start the process. As you had the original bill, there's also sunset dates placed every 2 years, so we will have to come back and review a lot of these that are coming up in the next year. That will be addressed as we move forward.
The Director of Brady Anderson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson, committee chair Representative Meyer, also these were the ones that were specifically identified by legislative finance in the report to be terminated. So those were the ones that were certainly recommended for termination.
Thank you, Andrew. Do you guys know how many tax credits are out there? I thought that there was 60 or 65.
In the Department of Revenue, there's only a little over 10, but less than 20 actual designated tax credits within the Department of Revenue. And the genesis of the indirect expenditure report was to go beyond the scope of the credit and look at other ways that the state may have been losing less revenue. And so the first report had I believe I'm going to say it was 150 pages worth of a document that had mostly double-sided or single-sided expenditures identified from just different or four different departments.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very
much. Appreciate your
time today. Thank you. So with that, I'll make a motion to move.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the Census Report Number 155, which now has a similar report / number from Committee of Individual Recommendations and attached to the
Any objection to the committee members? Okay, seeing none, so moved. It will take a brief moment. Welcome to the Labor and Commerce Committee, back in order. Next, we have Senate Bill 201, which is an act relating to the Board of Pharmacy, relating to the licensing and inspection of certain facilities located outside the state, relating to drug supply chain security, and creating a position of executive administrator for the Board of Pharmacy. So this is the second hearing of the bill. Intent is to conclude public testimony, take members' questions, and look to the role of the committee. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and continue public testimony. Is there anybody here in junior who would like to testify on Senate Bill 201? Okay. And so next online, we have Dirk White, who is the past president of the Board of Pharmacy, calling from SECA. Mr. White, would you like to provide your testimony on Senate Bill 201?
I am not the representative of the Airway Town of Pharmacy in Sitka, Alaska. Practicing for 31 years here in Sitka, and the need has put out for a pharmacy. I have stepped out of this already, I'm very busy with it. And for questions, there's just many other current board members that are available today.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. White? Mr. White, I'll say questions for you. We also have Jay Hamilton in the room for any questions of the department or any questions for the department. Okay. Seeing none, Senator Diesel, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 201, bringing LIC 140, due by Slash Overhead Committee with Individual Organizations, 3-Diesel Mode.
Thank you, and thank you for yourself. The committee board, if you have any questions, appreciate it. And we'll take a brief study. House Committee back to order. Next on the agenda is Senate Bill 175. This is an act relating to the registration and duties of pharmacy benefits managers, relating to procedures, guidelines, and enforcement mechanisms for pharmacy audits, relating to the cost of multi-source generic drugs and insurance reimbursement procedures, relating to the duties of the Director of the Division of Insurance, and providing for an effective date. So this is the bill's second hearing. The intent is to adopt a committee substitute to take members' questions, give public testimony, and then look to the will of the committee. So with that, I'd like to move the committee substitute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 175, or the LS1110/telesalting document.
Thank you all again for discussion and explanation of the changes. I would like to introduce President Meyer of my staff and then the Department of the Senate Review System.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee for Member Weston Adler, Senate to the Senate Legal and Commerce Committee. Madam Chair, I think they're due to the sponsor for working extensively with stakeholders and other affected parties on this bill. With your permission, I'll just highlight two elements and then be happy to defer to the sponsor staff to kind of walk through some of the technical changes. Overall, Madam Chair, the CS moves the regulation of pharmacy benefit managers and their registration to the section of statute that deals with third-party administrators and also addresses some of the issues with regards to interest and adjudicated claims at an effective date. But there's a lot of work waiting to this with the stakeholders, and I'm happy to defer to our sponsor staff to walk through.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Jane Cobbless. I'm just sitting here at the easel. I will briefly go over the changes going from the original bill version W to the committee substitute version, which is H. And section 1 has to do with registration of pharmacy benefit managers as for business practice. And as Weston previously said, it moves the pharmacy benefit manager registration to Title 21, 27, 630 that governs third-party administrators. It outlines what a PBM may do on its structure, particularly slides 8 through 20 of version W regarding registration. Then it moves on to section 21.7905, renewal of registration. It changes the renewal of the registration from annual to biannual. Section 21.27910, pharmacy audit procedural requirements. As those required under AS 31.3695, the subject covers procedures for timely payment of claims, and that direct adjudication of a claim and no interest may accrue. And that's from section D12.5, that must be a pharmacist's license and good standing in Alaska. It complies with the pharmacy statute, which is OAB, when the audit involves clinical or professional judgment. 21.27915, overpayment or underpayment, has language that does not allow extrapolation of figures in calculation of an over or underpayment unless the PBM and the pharmacy agree to a statistically agreed upon projection. Section 21.27920, recruitment, removes reference to corrective action plan in the bill. 21.97925 is pharmacy audit reports, and in that section there's been no changes. Section 21.27930, pharmacy audit appeal, future repayment, clarifies in C that section that is the PDF appeal process that must be exhausted. 21.27955, H deletes the entire text that was originally W and rewrites it. I can read it for you, can give me a lot or you can read it, but it is rewritten. When pharmacy benefit manager is conducting a audit on a pharmacy, fraudulent activity is defined as an intentional act of theft, deception, misrepresentation, or concealment committed by the pharmacy, which is discovered during the course of an audit, unintentional clerical or record-keeping errors, including typographical errors, writer's errors, or computer errors regarding a required document or record, shall not be considered fraudulent activity. Moving on to Section 21.27945, as to the depth of a single list procedural requirements, there's no change in that section. 21.27950, multi-source generic drug appeal, that's in E of that section. And it requires a request to hearing under 4106170, that governs procedure for hearings by the Division of Insurance. It takes out the 30 calendar days in perpetuity, since that would all be covered under that statute. 21.27955 is the definition section, and there are no changes in that. Sections 2 through 5, there are no changes. Section 6 only changes the effective date from January 1 to July 1, 2017. Madam Chair, that is the gist of the changes from version Bill 2 to version H.
So on section 21.27.915, which is the in section 1, the overpayment or underpayment, could you explain the purpose of making this change in the bills is, allows the PBM to pharmacy to agree with statistically equivalent projection and avoid underpayment or overpayment?
Madam Chair, it is kind of practice during PBM audits that if they find an error that they think might be something that they would see throughout a period of time, they have a model that can extrapolate that cost up to, let's say, they're happened 20 more times in X amount of time. They extrapolate that price out and multiply it by the number of better frequency that they think could happen. And that can take an error of $800 and extrapolate that to end up being like a $9,000 bill. That's just based on extrapolation. So pharmacies feel that is not really very fair. And so if they could agree on some kind of model together in a contract, then the section provides for that.
Thank you. And we also have Corey Winkler on the Division Director of the Division of Insurance of Colonial. And Ms. Winkler, this is Senator Costello. I was hoping mentioned to the committee, does the state of Alaska use PBMs and how this bill affect the state?
Senior Stevens.
wonder about it, and even just addressing the issue of honest, that would be one reason was that the case, so we've been under 4 months in the past, and one of them said that he hired the family and re-emerging for services.
At this point, PDM should be registered with the division. I think we checked out with regulations. There was only 4 registration, there was only 2 that had actually registered with the division, even though we are confident that our definition of third party administrator requires that they do. So they are not at this point licensed in the state.
Even business people would want the many contracts that you negotiated with somebody
amounts of deviance and engagement practices where they find some people that no longer care about their kids as well, they got their name correctly on a prescription on their patient form, but because of that, they validate that claim even though the drug ended up in the patient's hands and they were the right drug for the prescribed coming to harm. But you don't get them and validate that combination and validate the doctor correctly. But then they want to run a practice of extrapolation.
Questions.
Council with Fulton with the National Association of Chain Grocers, calling in from Olympia, Washington. Committee members, are there any questions for either of those individuals? Okay, seeing none, thank you for going in. Do you have everybody's?
And and they have 3,000 workers and they know how, you know, basically, they don't care if you're a friend of Bruce and Sergio, you know, they want to be able to go to the car. One thing, you hear a single story about CBS Wi-Fi, you know, totally horrible. That's not the case at all. And I think what you're really, doing is you're doing horror stories that are really, for the most part, being perpetuated by, you know, federal rules and laws that you guys are not going to change, and this bill is not going to change. What this bill is doing is going to cost the same last of money. It's going to take away an important tool as you go up for the private sector, for businesses to lower their healthcare costs. And then the last result of this, you know, but, you know, not just on that, you know, you can actually talk to an actuarial and find out what it does to your retirement costs. Because that's really, and what happens is we always play this game, and starting later in Congress, we always do it when the bill never passes. And I guess, you know, I am a professor for us, but it's been closed box in the committee. But I think that if you look into this a little bit deeper, and you understand a little bit more, I'm not so sure it's going to be, you know, the level of it that everyone thinks it is. I understand and I feel for the local pharmacies. My pharmacies, you know, once they're not testifying. If they were going to testify, and I said, good evening. And they told me the owners of the studios, and I said, you didn't work for it. And they never told them that this is not going to change how they do business. So my client was going to testify to them. They didn't realize it. They too. It's an honor that they have been ready. And they were going to testify. They would remind them, God, you know, local law doesn't trump federal law. You know, what was their conference going to do? And I think that what you're doing is doing a role of service to the business community and your costs. You know, a lot of private sector employers, a lot more money. And I would say, if there's a rush, there's a rush to do something right. But I said, how can this bill this year not have a fiscal vote? When every year before they're there, the administration's just slowly coming up with it. You know, I know they're working on it, and there will be a cost, and it's something to be considered. But, you know, I mean, if I didn't even call the Chamber of Commerce, they could post this bill. I'd have to know about this bill. You know, and I think that the main businesses in Alaska have EBMs know about this bill. And I'm thinking of the pharmacists. You know, it's true that, you know, their resource normalizes the audit. And I've been telling you, the really egregious audits are the federal government audits. And their private sector PBMs that they use, and most of all, does nothing to it. So it does, you know, for a private sector versus public sector view, you know, you see companies that are theirs, but the private sector view is screening, you don't get yours. So, you know, I think you don't look at winners and losers. That's like, you know, I hear a lot of people all the time, I don't look at winners and losers. That's what you're doing this way. You're picking winners. And you make letters named the pharmacist, you know, that's your, you know, what's your cost? I thought, as your choice, the losers are the private sector business community and the same patient. There's only the losers as a result of this. And again, it doesn't mean you're right or wrong, it's just the choice you're making today. And you know, and we'll talk about other bills in other states. Probably this evening, here's the last stop on this bill. Those of you who get frustration about this one, and all of, you know, the scripts and CBS and the people who have, you know, this place of opposition to this bill, they all came to Alaska, and they all sat down, and they brought the bottom legislation from, you know, the states that had it, and it was like, what's your deal with it? And it was a book after the things that they wanted, what was one of those things, they wanted that plus, plus, and plus. So I think that, we also need to audit. We need to audit too. blocking new company in the United States. Maybe does that want to be done? You know, so we face it too. So the thing is, you know, I think that the PBMs are willing to do something that makes reasonable and fair. I believe, but I know that they believe that this goes too far, that this goes further than what many other states offer. Now, I might never speak for that, but hearsay and what I hear in meetings, I'm not an expert on this, and I said, so these city testify. I've been through 33 years, this is about 4,000 years, and the thing that really brings me to the table today is I just see, you know, this rest of the finish line, and I think that there's a lot of other policy concerns that have not been addressed. But that, I mean, that, when is it something, you know, what is the fiscal, what's not a good fiscal? And what is, I mean, in this age, you know, with the fiscal crisis and challenges that we're faced with,
Is there any objection from committee members?
Okay, seeing none, the rule is moved and the text three is set by the school for adopt and everything. Welcome back to the Senate Bill of Commerce, and next on our agenda, we have Senate Bill 156, which is an act making insurance coverage for contraceptives and related services relating to medical assistance coverage for contraceptives and related services and providing for the affected date. And so today is the bill's first hearing. The intent is to hear from the sponsor and the sponsor's staff, hear from the administration, take medical quick questions, and then open public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further review as we normally do in the later office committee. So with that, I'd like to welcome Senator Bob Gardner and her staff, Kate Rubin, who are going to present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Senator Bob Gardner. I represent Midtown Anchorage, and the bill before you is not nearly as controversial as the bill you just had up. So what it's about is that currently, with the exception of some religious exemptions, anyone is mandated to have health insurance, and all policies include coverage for birth control. Oftentimes, insurers make self-administered hormonal birth control, primarily the pill with derivative forms, available on a monthly or three-monthly increment. As suggested in Bill 156, would mean that after an initial three-month usage, to demonstrate that a woman is not experiencing complications, she'd be able to request a 12-month supply if she wished to do so. All existing co-pays would remain in effect, and not every woman would want a whole year's supply at a time, so not anybody would use this provision. But the goal is really narrow. If you're an individual covered by insurance and you get prescriptions for hormonal contraceptions, you get 12 months of time if you want. In states that have implemented this policy, they've seen a cost savings in all insurance polls that are affected by the law. Washington State has expenses estimated $4 million by AM, Medicaid savings since implementation. And you'll see that our own fiscal note is a savings of about $1.35 billion a year. And that is a result of cost implemented. So, over the course of working on this bill and having some committee hearings, we've heard from a lot of Alaskans who have had significant difficulty in getting a consistent supply of birth control. There are limited clinic hours, there are privacy concerns, and long searches of time where people might be in remote areas, and all these problems contribute to barriers that are in place in accessing contraception. So, it's good policy, it saves state money, and offers a lot of benefits to women who are using birth control. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions about community members? I have a question. So, can you explain to us how the state is able to meetings?
Well, the chair can write it out, can you go to the papers?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the recommendation to the owner, and Senator Bill Gerber. So, this one should be included in the bill package, but what we're seeing and what it's estimated by us is the cost savings will come in two main ways. One is for identified pregnancies covered by Medicaid, and then the other is because a lot of insurance providers do negotiate for lower costs for bulk supply of medication. So that's where they saw Washington State, that's where their fiscal note came from, their most promised on their government actually in 2015. But yeah, you can refer to this fiscal page 2. This is the one that shows the 1.3 million cost savings. It's starting fiscal year 2018.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? I appreciate that. I think Paul is here and the realm of she's about she's not planning to put it in the administration. Welcome to introduce yourself to the community and provide any opinion. My name is Michelle Michelle, and I'm the Chief of the Division of Retirement Benefits within the Department of Administration, and I'm here to administer the Union of Alaska Fairgrounds Employee Health Plan and the Alaska Fairgrounds Plan. It is important to note that we do not administer all the plans that cover all state employees. There are many state employees covered under the Union Health Trust that are outside of our plan. So, we contend that this bill actually does not impact this directly. However, our plan does offer, our employee plan offers, extensive benefits, and we are working towards another grant for this status on January 1, 2017, which makes them offer a full suite of specific benefits and their afforded under the Affordable Care Act. So those would be provided to individuals without co-pay as a grant of service. We do have, within our plan, the ability to, although we limit to a 90-day supply, we do have within our plan the ability to offer extended supply in cases where somebody will be traveling or otherwise unavailable to receive medication on a 90-day basis. We also do offer mail-order capabilities if they don't have areas that they don't have to go into a clinic or they don't have to travel to pick up a prescription from a retail pharmacy, so we do have the capability to deliver to the door to help reduce some of the barriers that Senator Burnham was referring to. So, again, we don't oppose this bill, we don't believe it applies to us, and we do believe that our benefits are substantially the same, if not better, in some cases, with the first one of them. The fact that we do so limit to a 90-day supply versus a 12-month supply, but we do make exceptions for that to help in cases where there are access or issues. So, we believe that because we do have these contingencies for a number of our sanitary supplies, that we would not see a large decrease in unexpected pregnancies, or we would anticipate that there would be a large decrease in unexpected pregnancies. So we don't believe that there would be significant cost savings to our plan. Okay. That was actually going to be my question. If at some point in the future did apply, do you extract that from the fiscal note that we have before us that we can see additional savings? And so you're saying that the fiscal note we can now essentially not change, not actually if at some future date we were able to. Right. There would be some savings for both discounts and reduced dispensing fees. But otherwise, again, we have a very different population than the Medicaid population, the demographics of your population. We don't believe that there would be an expensive change in the amount of unexpected or anticipated pregnancies. It would be something like the types of savings that all the health services is anticipating. Thank you. Not have any questions.
So, compared to this mail order option, are you using local pharmacies to mail order the prescription?
Good question. So, we are not. We do have
Howard Bannister as their member of the U.S. Department of Energy, so that is a good part of the history of the program.
That will, of course, be allocated in another seat.
Thank you.
Thank
you. I really appreciate it. Next, on the line, we have Aaron, the U.S. Eastern Ocean State Pharmacist from the Department of Health and Social Services. Aaron, are you available?
Yes, Madam Chair.
If you could just provide any comments you have for the committee on the bill.
The committee is taking comments. We appreciate the work that we've been able to do to make the bill on this bill and look at the actual bill. If there are questions, can you give us an answer?
Thank you very much, Aaron. This is Senator Diesel, Senator Felsen, on this one. I have a question for you. The bill actually covers much more than prescriptive contraceptives. I'm looking on page 1, lines 10 through 12. Actually, this is 1 and 12, but 10 through 12 is what it says. So, prescription contraceptives are A, but B is voluntary sterilization procedures. There's item C, which talks about prescribed dispense, et cetera, the drugs, devices, and other products provided under this paragraph. So does this expand Medicaid benefits?
So people in this particular section, being from page 1, lines 10 through page 2,
this is Senator Diesel. So, going to the Medicaid section, which is section 2 of the bill, on page 3, it says this: these prescriptions are dispensed without copay. Is that the standard for all prescriptions under Medicaid?
Thank you. I should ask Senator Diesel. Any further questions for Ms. Norris from the committee members?
Okay.
Thank you very much for making yourself available. So next, I'd like to go ahead and open public testimony on the bill, and I'd like to invite Christine Manning of the Board of Voters, who's here in the room. Welcome. Next, I'll have Allison Curry.
Madam Chair, good evening, members. I'm Christine Meany. I live in Douglas, Alaska, and I'm representing the Biden Bond Voters, and I have a position statement that I'd like to read from the committee. The Legal Bond Voters of Alaska strongly support Senate Bill 156, a bill related to insurance coverage for contraceptives and other services that reduce the risk of unintended pregnancies. At the national level, the Legal Bond Voters of the United States supports primary care for all, care that includes prenatal and reproductive health. When women have the consistent ability to plan their pregnancies, if that is an advocate for greater financial well-being, healthier living conditions, healthier children, greater opportunities, and myriad of additional benefits. While improving the quality of life for families, the ability to avoid unintended pregnancies also reduces the costs for state and federal governments. In 2010, according to the Great Mountain Institute, the state of Alaska spent nearly $43 million on health costs related to unintended pregnancies, while the federal government added another $71 million for the total cost of $114 million. Great Mountain reports that 48% of all pregnancies in Alaska in 2010 were unplanned, and 64% of Alaska's unplanned pregnancies were publicly funded, representing the $43 million. In addition, the cost benefits of supporting women in their efforts to plan their pregnancies falls far behind the cost of the pregnancy itself. A woman who is able to plan a pregnancy can better guarantee better health is at optimum level prior to pregnancy, reducing the risk of a difficult pregnancy and trauma to the child. Such planning reduces the possibility of increased health problems for the child. Problems which can follow the child for years and require increased health and education costs for the state. A planned pregnancy increases the woman's ability to manage her role as an income provider for a family and allows the family the best opportunity to remain as financially independent as possible. Supporting affordable contraceptives prescribed on a 12-month basis will undoubtedly reduce the number of unintended pregnancies in Alaska, thereby increasing family well-being and reducing state costs. Senate Bill 156 canvasses women and families to plan pregnancies so they are ready for the added responsibility of a child. In addition, costs of the state for unintended pregnancies can be reduced. This is a win-win bill that deserves consideration by the legislature, especially as it struggles with the budget crisis. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony. Senator, you all.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm not sure I understand correctly, so I'll ask for clarification. It sounds like you said that a child born as a result of an unplanned pregnancy is at a disadvantage. So it's just separates various things.
Sometimes a pregnancy can be a difficult pregnancy, and children who are unplanned often are not able to be cared for by their families as well as planned pregnancies.
So I guess I might use the word extremely, you're saying that they're better off never having been born. Perhaps I'm losing it off, but thank you.
Yeah, I would say it that way.
Sure not.
Next question is by Allison Curry. And then following Allison, we have Elizabeth Hiding.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Allison Curry. I'm a resident of Montreal, and I represent Planned Parenthood of Northwestern Hawaii. I'm participating today in support of insurance coverage for 12 months on medical schedule when prescribed by a healthcare provider. And I would like to thank Senator Gardner and her staff team for their leadership on this initiative, as well as their tireless work on this bill. As an advocate provider in regard to healthcare for all, Planned Parenthood has long supported sincere efforts to expand access to birth control. And we believe that every woman should have full access to birth control if they ever choosing, without barriers based on cost and availability. A good supply of birth control at a time is a solution that lowers barriers and works for women. 9 in 4 women say they have missed pills because they could not get that stack in time. Consistent use of birth control is the best way to prevent unintended pregnancy for those who are sexually active, and getting a 1-year supply dramatically improves consistent use.
according to a study published in Obstetrics and Gynecology, dispensing a 1 year supply at a time reduces the odds of experiencing an unintended pregnancy by 30% and is also associated with a 46% drop in the chance of needing an abortion, which I believe is all from the evidence here. Furthermore, dispensing 12 months of birth control would save significant money for the state and private insurance carriers as stated by the bill sponsor. A study from the University of California, San Francisco found that insurance plans that dispense a 1 year supply of birth control as opposed to limiting dispensing to 1 to 3 cycles lowers their direct costs on follow-up visits and pregnancy tests, as well as long-term unintended pregnancy management. Although I have a team who also experienced the rates of unintended pregnancy, they're forcing the state significant money on pregnancy and associated costs. We believe that women's consistent access to birth control should not depend on her insurance carrier, and we continue to be committed to working with other stakeholders to create the best possible legislation for all parties in order to help reduce barriers to contraceptives, prevent unintended pregnancy, and save the state additional money. I hope that you will join us at the point of this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Do you have any questions? I actually have a question. So the correlation between the lack of birth control and unplanned pregnancies and when clients come in to keep them there, do you take information about why they got pregnant? Is that something that you have some data on?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I feel like we do. So you're asking that when a patient comes in and they want to get pregnant, do we ask questions about how they got pregnant?
Well, we've heard a couple of folks make the assumption that not having the birth control available and having a year supply would prevent unplanned pregnancy, so that that part would logically say then that the reason that they were pregnant is like, did they ran out of birth control? And I'm wondering if that's something you keep track of.
So this bill sounds benign enough if it's just about discussing contraceptives. But as I pointed out, item B says voluntary sterilization procedures.
I believe, as you say, Senator, so I believe that language is in the bill because that is under the Affordable Care Act mandate. So the birth control mandate, that's through the Affordable Care Act. That's why I'm going to say that.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In our group, my name is Elizabeth Biggest, and I'm speaking about myself today. I'm a junior resident, and I'm currently a PhD candidate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And this summer, I got the control from the Minnesota State Fair. And the DNA order to support SB156 to help make it possible for women throughout Alaska to obtain their contraceptives all at the same time. In my opinion, this bill is a no-brainer, where so many residents in Alaska spend significant portions of the year in rural locations, myself included. That's why I am talking full time based on surgeries for 5 out of 7 days outside of the state of Sitka and at sea. We were 7 days a week on Twitter. And many times in the past, I've had to cancel doctor appointments repeatedly or delay the projects in order to get additional care for myself and my crew. While some of those doctor visits and issues may have been unavoidable, having to alter the schedules not only of my crew and myself, but also of the 12 people that we serve, for something as simple as a pre-approved contraceptive medication, just paying a prescription seems frustrating and unnecessary. I believe that this bill would save many individual women money and time, as well as help deter costs related to unplanned pregnancies that may result from not having consistent access to contraception. So I urge you to please vote yes on SB156 if this is a responsible choice for women's health in Alaska. I also would just like to speak to a comment that was made earlier. I don't think we're
been talking about what happens with children that are born from an infant is as well as and women who are illegally receiving abortion, and whether or not they can just sit back for 12 months or 30. And so I think that there are a lot of different emotional issues that really are not contained in this bill. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Next, Samantha Sullivan, she's been in Fairbanks. Samantha, if you could introduce yourself to the committee.
Hi, my name is Samantha Sullivan, and I'm from the CDI Departmental. I spent time today to encourage you to support medical legal defense. Unfortunately, my medical contraception is better than this place for various personal medical reasons. I have two women facing more barriers trying to access all medications due to geographic and occupational reasons. In case of my own life, the family was needing more time, but they decided to take time off work to get a doctor and jump into their prescription, so I wholeheartedly support this bill. I can share personal story when I left Grant to go to the county university of Alaska Fairbanks trying to get my prescription refilled. Was an incredible burden as I transitioned from working full-time to going to school while working. Going to the doctor's office was not financially realistic for me at the time, and I had to go to the dentist to get my normal supplies until I was able to get back on my feet. Having the ability to have 4 months of birth control covered by insurance and Medicaid at one time saved costs for the doctor's visits, costs for the women seeking medication, and also saved money related to plans for the pregnancy. I urge you to support this bill, but we have a positive impact on the lives of many Alaska women. Thank you.
Next,
I'm going to the Anchorage, Ohio, where there are two individuals, Robin Smith, followed by Kenny Pesnack-Lippin.
Hi, this is Robin Smith, and I just want to say thank you for allowing me to testify to this bill. One thing I'm going to open up is that I'm in Anchorage, I'm
I also treat
acne and eczema, and they also
federal rules to impose a global tariff that any state mandate after October 31st, 2011, a new mandate triggered the state to spread across the new coverage for all individual and small group qualified health plans. And this is applicable for mandates that go beyond the tariff threshold benefit. The provisions finally come to our short consideration of the service provision and a thorough review of all the required offerings to ensure that they are not in the mandate, otherwise they will have to pay for the new benefit. The bill I've also adopted would impact grandfathering health plans. These are private, private insurance options, individual and group health plans.
Thank you.
and when I was told by the insurance carrier that she could process this alone with it. And something else that's really important, oftentimes if you have a pack of pills as being one month supply, but many women actually only use 21 days out of each pack of this story for 7 pills a day in March. And this actually provides another level of effectiveness, increased effectiveness. So you can use only 17 packs for 1 year. As I said, I work in the home farming clinic here in Homer, and one of the dignities for being an IT is in the home winner. I have anecdotes, and they don't take us what I mentioned to you earlier. We have clients that did not have insurance, and so we have been able to use that to dispense 12 months contraceptives to them at one time. And they report a much better ability to take that medication and take it reliably. So I have no doubt in one strategy plan that respects some people not to be able to speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Dirk White, Sitka, with the past president of Mark Garcia. Welcome, Sir White.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for your comment. This is Dirk White, Governor of Mark Garcia, Sitka, Alaska, and I've had both partners in the world here for over 30 years. And I'm curious about your support in the field, and I can corroborate a lot of the stories that I've learned about the film of production, so people are sort of unsure.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll take
still picking from the RCA. And then I unfortunately, our members have other committees too, so we will be bringing this bill back up. So, Ms. Herbert, I see you're online for questions only.
Yes, online for questions only.
Okay, thank you. This is Senator Costello. So, this bill is an extension of a statute that's already on the books. My question to you is, we heard from the sponsor staff that it helps people also open for business and it prevents some projects from regulatory costs that can affect the project. But my question is, has it worked in your estimation with the intention that it's originally set forth to accomplish?
I think it's fair to say that the original extension had a fairly narrow focus, and so Mr. Levitt indicated that there was one project on Fire Island that was approved in a long-term power purchase agreement between Mastery and Phoenix Electric. Beyond that, we have approved that power purchase agreement, and I think it is fair to say that some of the concerns and questions early on that the commission had, the representations made in terms of durability, regulation, stability of the grid, those concerns have been alleviated. And it has provided a fairly flat long-term power purchase agreement that will into the future. How it will move forward with the extension being extended to 2020 with our recent regulations approved that added some clarification on what the cost of the system with the energy components and advanced components, I think will hopefully have a little bit more clarity. So the commission has not formally taken a position for this particular exemption. We believe that's a policy goal by the legislature. But I think it's fair to say that the narrow exemption has performed as it was originally represented to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Pickett, and thank you for serving on the RCA, and I will be putting in a tremendous amount of time on behalf of Alaskans.
Thank you.
And so I can now go with one additional person. So, Dr. Mitchell would be like the Independent Power Producers Association here in the room. And Mr. Mitchell, if you could be so kind as to limit your testimony to the remaining minutes we have until 3:30 when we need to head out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Scott Kennedy, is the Executive Director of the Alaska Independent Power Producers Association. We represent particularly everybody that's not a utility that's either developing or operating power projects. This bill, even though it may have had a narrow focus, has served somehow an open light for other independent power producers. We now have a growing cadre of power producers in Alaska. We are the only state that regulates small power producers. And so I know that we have a lot of concerns with this building and process and federal overreach. To me, this is a factor of state overreach. This bill is nothing except expand what is already on the books. And we would ask that the body here consider extending that date such that we can keep the open light on for noise and jobs and other developments in the renewable energy sector in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. How many members are of the Power Association?
We have nine.
Okay. And as far as the RCA provides helpful public good and some members of the understanding that the federal regulations already address any concerns that the public might have.
These are what we feel very strongly that this doesn't cure the state overreach, but we, if you look at what other states regulate versus Alaska, we are overregulated for small power producers. And it's correct, all this bill does is just extend that. We're already exempt underneath the federal law, anything underneath 80 megawatts. This is 65 megawatts, which is even lower than the federal requirement. So, we just announced that we don't go backwards and we at least maintain what we already have and we need to consider less regulation in the future.
Great, thank you for that explanation. Okay, with that, I am going to adjourn today's meeting and keep public testimony open. I apologize to those who have been on the line. We have a lot of bills on our agenda today. And my committee, Chris and I, will be in touch with you, Master, and we will be planning for this Celtics. So with that, good evening to you.